This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the state of the craft beverage industry with MIBiz reporter John Wiegand. But first, the governor's office and a United States Senate seat will be at the top of the ballot next year in Michigan. It's a judgment call as to whether it's too early to discuss a report on the moves being made to try and win elections in 2018. But it clearly is not too early to raise money for next year's races. The Michigan Campaign Finance Network finds that fundraising committees for both the Republican and Democratic parties are raising lots of money. The Michigan Campaign Finance Network's director, Craig Mauger, joins us from Lansing. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I don't think it's too early to start talking about the 2018 election because, everyone in the Capitol is already focused on that. So I don't think it's too early for the public to hear about it.
Well, let's begin then with how much money we are talking about here. What are the totals that we look at for the campaign committees for both the Republicans and the Democrats?
Yeah, so what we looked at is the first quarter campaign disclosures that the main fundraising committees of the four legislative caucuses had to turn in. So legislative caucuses here are the House Republicans, the Senate Republicans, the House Democrats, and the Senate Democrats. So these are four longstanding committees in Michigan who raise money to pour into competitive House and Senate races in the state, and they're usually the top spenders in these competitive races. For the first quarter of 2017, so this is January 1st through April 20th, not a lot of time, these four committees combined to raise $2.10 million, which is the highest total that they've reported over that time in an off year, a non-election year, dating back to 2007, and they narrowly didn't beat out the number from 2007 when it was 2.12, and in 2017 it was 2.10.
As of now, is there one party that has a distinct advantage over the other?
Yeah, as of right now, the Republican committees are really out fundraising their Democratic counterparts, which isn't surprising because the party in power tends to attract more donations to their caucus committees. The Republicans have control of the House and the Senate and the legislature, which gives them a leg up on fundraising. That may not have been the case as much in 2016 because there was leading up to the 2016 election, a lot of people felt that the House Democrats were in a great position to make some gains and maybe even come very close to taking a majority. So a lot more donations tracked the House Democrats' way in the 2015-2016 cycle. This time, however, in the first quarter, you saw House Republicans report a major fundraising advantage. They raised $817,000, the House Republican committee did, over the first quarter. The House Democrats were down around $400,000 over that quarter. So that's a significant margin for the House Republicans.
I think back to 2007, that year you referenced where actually the record amount was raised. Mm-hmm. That was coming off a year in 2006 in which the Democrats almost took control of the state Senate and they had control of the state House. And then I think about what you said about competitive races, and it seems to me that there were probably more competitive races going from that 2006 to 2008 election cycle. With more money being raised, the same amount of money being raised now as 10 years ago, could we be looking at roughly the same amount of money, perhaps more if the pace picks up, being funneled into fewer races because they can focus with the analytics they have on the few races that they think will be competitive?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what we've seen in Michigan over the past, past cycle since 2010. More and more money is being funneled to a smaller group of competitive races. So the 10 races that are the most competitive, attracting the most money, are getting larger and larger amounts each cycle. I think we had 7 or 8 races that went over $1 million for the state house in 2016 alone. So, I mean, that's a lot of money to be spent on a race that will fill one out of 110 seats in the state capitol.
But as I think back to those races that you highlighted, three of those were here in Southwest Michigan, and a couple of those might be close again. But I could also imagine, say, the 66th district not being as contested because the Republicans won it pretty convincingly in 2016. So could we be focusing even on a smaller number of races if you know, they take the 2016 election and look at those? Or could it be that maybe some other districts that didn't get attention last time are viewed by the parties differently this time around?
Yeah, I think there's always going to be, you know, about a dozen races where the money is focused, and as the election gets closer, it might go down from there. But if the House Democrats win this election, does roll around, and they have a better idea of what the trends are across the state, I mean, if the House Democrats feel they have a chance to take back a majority, which they would have to flip a lot of seats, the Republicans have 63 of the 110 seats, they're going to have to play in a lot of races to try to push that, to make a majority play. And the financial advantage that the House Republicans have right now is going to be a major potential problem for House Democrats. And House Democrats as well have been telling, you know, donors cycle after cycle recently that this is the year we're going to flip the majority. And cycle after cycle, they haven't really come that close to flipping the majority. So they've got to find a new argument, a new path to explain to their donors of this is the cycle that we can do it, and here's why. And that's the challenge that's before them. I mean, and that could be one of the reasons that the House Republicans had such a major fundraising advantage over the first quarter of 2017.
When we compare these numbers to 2 years ago, is it important to put in context that the state Senate is going to be up in 2018 and the state Senate was off the board for 2016?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the state Senate, the Senate committees are going to raise a lot more money over the next 2 years than they raised the previous 2 years because it's leading up to an election. The thing with the state Senate is that a handful of races will be really expensive, and there will be a lot of money raised for them. But across the general election map, you know, there's only a handful of races that could even be potentially competitive because of the way the districts are and the partisan breakdown of the districts. So it's really hard for the Democrats, who I think have right now 11 of the 38 seats, to say that we're going to make a majority play. So really their play is to try to pick up as many seats as possible, and they're going to play in a handful of competitive districts. I'm sure the seat over there in your area that Margaret O'Brien holds will be one that could see a lot of money flowing its way.
Very close in 2014.
Yeah,
as well.
And it was the most, in 2014, it was close, and it was the most expensive state Senate race in the state's history.
Greg, do we have two trends here that might be coming into conflict, and we'll have to see how they play out? And I'm thinking that for Republicans, there's momentum on their side in that they won the presidency and Michigan's electoral votes for the first time since 1988 in the last election. So they have, of course, won all the statewide offices now the last couple of election cycles. And they're trying to get maybe their last big breakthrough here, which would be to win a U.S. Senate seat, which they haven't done since 1994. Democrats, on the other hand, may be counting on the idea that the party that's out of power in the White House normally does better in midterm elections. So are those two things coming into conflict, and maybe are those two things persuasive arguments that can be used when making fundraising appeals?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, I think on both sides of the aisle, there are some patterns that are somewhat going in their favor. And I think you touched on most of them. On the Republican side, the thing that they're going to be pitching to donors is, well, one, we have all the power. Let's give to try to keep this. And when you're in power, it's easier to raise money. And then two is the fact that Michigan has been trending a bit Republican. I mean, for Donald Trump to have won the general election in Michigan after GOP presidential candidate after GOP presidential candidate had lost, that's a positive momentum position for Republicans to be in. And I should throw in there as well, the Republican legislative committees have had so much success winning these races that's another quality pitch that I'm sure they're making to donors. on the Democratic side, like you said, the tendency in Michigan has been for a governor to hold that position for two terms, and then for the other party to win it the next time. So that's a really good point for Democrats to make to donors, and also the Democrats are going to be all over whatever Donald Trump's polling numbers are. And no matter what your belief is in polling, that's the fact. If his favorability is low, they're going to be pointing that out over and over again as an example of the potential for them to have success.
So this money that has been raised so far, how can it be spent? Can it be given directly to campaigns? Can it be used for issue ads, independent expenditures?
This money that we're primarily talking about today from the four caucus committees is most likely going to spend directly in races on TV advertisements that tell you, TV advertisements with the candidate campaigns that tell you to vote for that candidate or to vote against the opponent. I mean, that's how the majority of this money will likely be spent, TV ads, radio ads, things like that, in competitive Senate and House districts. This money doesn't include independent spending that will happen in the election. There will be numerous groups that set up shop in Michigan for 2018 and drop large sums of money to try to influence these races. When we talk about comparing these numbers to 2007, that's the big difference. There has been an explosion of independent spending in Michigan elections since 2007, and that's going to drive the price tag of that election upward significantly. And that's why, you know, I'm expecting, and our group that tries to track money in politics and shine light on it is kind of preparing for 2018, knowing that it could be an election cycle unlike any other in recent time because of having an open seat in the governor's office, an open attorney general position, open secretary of state position, and then these legislative races where the cost of them continue to go up cycle after cycle.
And we'll have to see if the U.S. Senate race turns out to be competitive and one that the Republicans do make a serious play for.
The U.S. Senate race, I didn't even touch on that, but this could be an extremely expensive race if both parties feel like it is one that they can win. And I think Republicans are most likely looking at it very closely right now and seeing what candidate they can recruit to see if they can make a serious play against Senator Stabenow. The Democrat, these U.S. Senate races are also getting more and more expensive every cycle. In 2016, we had the most expensive U.S. Senate race on record happen in Pennsylvania, and these are races that are drawing, you know, millions upon millions upon millions of dollars if they're close. These races devour TV time, TV advertising time if they're close. So if there is a close U.S. Senate race, batten down the hatches for your TV to be seeing a lot of political advertising next fall.
And one other possibility out there is that we could see one or more high-profile ballot issues make it before voters in 2018. There's a number of groups out there that plan to collect petition signatures. We don't know how successful they'll be at this point. But if you throw that into the mix, what could we be talking about, Craig, in terms of just sheer volume of money being spent on political advertising, et cetera?
I mean, it's really impossible to say what the final figure could be because a lot of that's going to depend on the nature of the ballot proposal, right? If the ballot proposals are something that both have donors that want to support them and donors that want to oppose them, the cost of running TV ads for a ballot proposal, the cost of that campaign could be a combined $20 million. $30 million. One of these to watch is this redistricting ballot proposal, because that's a ballot proposal where there will be a side that would be interested in spending money in favor of it, and likely a side that would have a lot of money to spend against it, because this is something that could decide, you know, legislative races for years to come. I mean, for the future. So there will be a lot of money spent in opposition to it if supporters are able to get something on the ballot, and then the supporters would have to raise a lot of money to keep it going. Medical marijuana is another one where a lot of money would have to be spent to make that case to the public. The question is really how much money would opposition groups spend, and that remains unclear.
I want to go back again to the point that we've made about the different worlds that we're in since 2007, when it was really the last time we saw this much money raised by the campaign committees. A big event that happened in between 2007 and now is the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. How much will that drive what we see when we actually get to 2018 and our TVs are filled with political advertisements?
Yeah, I think in the U.S. Senate race, that's one where the Citizens United could have a major impact, where there could be an absolute flood of spending by independent groups taking money from corporations and labor groups, taking money from sources that are mystery corporations that we don't really know where the money to those corporations is coming from. That's one to watch, and that's one of the reasons why U.S. Senate races and U.S. House races have become more expensive than ever. And just overall, even without Citizens United, there has been an upward trend in independent spending by groups that can accept unlimited contributions because they're supposedly acting independently of the campaigns. And what we're going to see cycle after cycle as this spending increases is the cost of the elections go up, the money given to these campaigns go up, and the murkiness of the ability of the public to figure out where this money is coming from also go up. So all of those are factors that will play out, and that's something that will be on full display, I suspect, in 2018.
So if we're going to make an apples-to-apples comparison here, or as close as we can, and we look back to 2014, that's the last time there was an election for governor, attorney general, secretary of state, state senate. What does that election cycle look like compared to what we're seeing ahead of 2018?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from these very early numbers, the caucus committees are ahead of where they were at in 2014. According to our tracking, the total cost of the state elections in 2014 was $134.6 million. And just to put that number in perspective, of that $134 million, $63 million, somewhat close to half of it, $63 million of that was from the race for governor. The race for governor in 2018, if it remains somewhat close, is going to be what drives up all these figures. It's what's going to dominate a lot of the TV advertising along with the U.S. Senate race if it's close. And it's the kind of race that will draw in donations from outside the state, will draw in donations by spending by independent groups. You talk about $63 million in 2014. That number could easily be surpassed in 2018 if the race is closed and if it's an open seat. And keep in mind, in 2014, we didn't have competitive primaries for that race for governor.
On either side.
Both parties were settled on who their candidates were going to be. And as we look at the playing field for 2018, I think both parties are expecting somewhat competitive primaries that will also cost money. I think I talked to some campaign consultants earlier this year who were telling me that they thought a candidate for governor in a competitive primary race would need to raise about $3 million for that primary. So that will just drive the cost up even more.
Craig Mauger, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Craig Mauger joined us from Lansing. Links to the network's reports on fundraising can be found at our website. You'll also find a longer version of this interview at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. It's definitely not easy anymore. That quote from one brewer opens the MIBiz series of stories on the state of the craft beverage industry. Reporters looked at trends, changes, and what are called growing pains of craft brewers. John Wiegand is a staff writer for MIBiz and one of the contributors to the series on craft beverages. John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So if we were trying to sum up the overall trend for the craft beverage industry, what might we say right now?
The industry is growing up, and that's causing some, like you said, and we said growing pains.
Does Michigan deviate significantly from other states? We know that we have a lot of brewers here, especially this side of the state, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. But are the trends similar in Michigan as we would probably find in most other states in the country?
I would say so. For most other states with similar population of craft brewers, the dynamics and industry trends kind of hold true across the country.
So you looked at the suppliers, so we're actually a step back from the brewers. What are they seeing, and what is it doing to their business?
Sure. So most of the suppliers that I talk to serve the smaller brewers, and that kind of fits a more national trend. Basically, the thinking goes that if you're a brewer, you're not going to be the next Bell's or the next Founders. You're going to come in and be a small brewer. So by and large, the volume of new brewers are small neighborhood brew pubs, and that's led to opportunities for these suppliers who kind of have carved out a niche for serving these smaller producers with small barrel brewing systems or smaller orders of hops and that sort of thing.
And we find out in one of your stories that the federal budget debate, which of course includes all sorts of things, also has an impact on the craft beverage industry. Explain what exactly is going on here.
Sure. So a lot of the hop and barley research programs are funded through federal portions of the federal budget, and you know, like everything, those budget cuts, like you said, there are a pretty wide ranging implication. The brewing industry right now is pretty focused on hop and barley research as a way to expand offerings and get different flavors and stuff like that in the beer, and it really does depend on these grants. Like I mentioned in the story, the Michigan State Extension Office relies quite a bit on this funding for their hop and barley research as well.
I suppose some people might wonder, with all of the different things we've seen craft brewers do, the different flavorings, the different sort of brews, how much left there is to truly research in terms of what you can do with hops and barley?
A lot of it is doing stuff for like disease resistance, allowing these hops or these crops to be grown in different climates. So, for instance, some varieties of hops don't do all that well in Michigan because they're susceptible to a disease called downy mildew. And Michigan being a wet area, that really is an issue. So there, some of the research is focused on trying to, expand the range or available planting area of these crops, make them more resistant, or in the case of barley, get them up to the quality standards that brewers are looking for.
Could the industry withstand a big cut in federal research dollars if it came? In other words, do they think that there's enough private money there and maybe some other resources they could turn to if, in fact, at some point these proposed federal budget cuts became reality?
That's a little uncertain of how much they could continue research, but they are looking inwards towards industry partners to fund that. The Brewers Association, that's a big trade group based out of Colorado. They're putting more and more dollars towards these projects, $500,000 in 2017. So there is some interest coming from the industry. I think craft brewers, especially the larger ones, recognize the need for this. So, the Brewers Association, American Malting Barley Association, they're definitely picking up some of the tab.
And you also have a story about what happens when the name of a particular brew gets a little edgy, shall we say, perhaps has a double entendre. Is this something which has become more common, less common in recent years?
I think it kind of ebbs and flows a little bit, to be honest. It seems like we've went through periods where it has been bigger of a problem, then it's kind of slowed down, and it appears to be ramping up again, maybe as more craft brewers enter the industry.
Do there seem to be more people expressing concerns about it from within the industry, looking around and saying, that's maybe not the best representation of our businesses as a whole?
Yeah, certainly there's been rumblings among individuals in the industry for quite some time, criticism over these labels. Recently at the Craft Beer Conference in Washington, D.C., the Brewers Association announced that they were making some changes to their marketing code and advertising code to address some of the branding for offensive beer or offensive beer labels, as they called them. So that's the first time that I've seen that, a large kind of trade group or governing body has made a comment on that. issue.
So how much influence does a trade group have over something as widespread, as independent-minded as craft brewing can be?
Right. That's an excellent question. I mean, on one hand, the Brewers Association is kind of the preeminent organization for craft brewers. The conference was enormous, and they do hold quite a bit of weight in the industry. On the other hand, like you mentioned, craft brewers are known to be rebellious and kind of going against the status quo a bit. So, I it's hard to say how much sway this is actually going to have. The Brewers Association did receive some criticism from those within the industry, pointing to their updates to their marketing code did not go far enough, that they lacked teeth of any enforcement of these offensive beer labels.
Is this one of those growing pains that we're talking about, that the craft beer industry maybe has been able to operate more like a teenage boy up until a point, and then maybe now as they're getting closer to adulthood, there's a different perception, and maybe some people in the industry feel a need to behave a little differently?
Yeah, I think so. One of the branding experts I talked to for my story likened it to the craft brewing industry still being in their pubescent years. And I think that holds true for in some cases. It's largely a business move. So craft brewers want to expand, you know, how many people drink craft beer and kind of court people away from the big domestic brands. So as a way to do that, they see markets for women drinkers and minority drinkers who, you know, typically or by and large haven't taken to craft beer as much as Caucasian males. So there's definitely a business case for this as well.
I want to go back to the quote at the beginning of this series of stories in MI Biz. It's definitely not easy anymore. What are the things that do make it challenging right now to be in the craft beverage industry?
Sure. So it depends on where you are in the craft beverage industry. If we're talking about the regional players like Founders and Bell's, or maybe even a little bit bigger than those, they're finding it challenging to still, you know, maintain their footprint, you know, through distribution. So, I mean, basically they're getting squeezed at the top end from, you know, the big producers like Anheuser-Busch and other producers that have gotten into craft. And they're also being squeezed on the bottom end by brewers who have opened neighborhood brew pubs and the like. So, you know, they're trying to find ways to stay competitive in between those goalposts. Whereas if you're a small brewer, I mean, there's a host of challenges. You know, it's similar to starting any business. The day of being able to just throw out a craft beer product into the market and be marginally successful enough to stay open, you know, 5 years is kind of come and went. Most people in the industry say that, you know, you really have to know your stuff, not only about brewing, but also about business to be successful. So having craft on your label doesn't seem to cut it anymore.
And is there also maybe a different landscape that the smaller brewers are stepping into, that it really is at this point hard to imagine someone becoming the next Bell's or the next Founders because of just how saturated the market is?
Definitely, and that comes into play really with retail shelf space. So there's only so much room on store shelves for beer, and it's harder for these smaller players to, they don't have the resources like the bigger players to, you know, spread out their product. So really the constraint is on shelf space, and with so many more choices in the market, it's going to be very challenging for someone to become the next Bell's or the next Founders.
So is a smaller brewer then thinking that if they can operate a brew pub, sell their beer there, maybe add food, that can be a place where they can sort of carve out their place in the market?
Certainly, and most of the kind of the old hands in the industry would advise young brewers that or new breweries that's probably their best bet. You know, you open up a neighborhood brew pub, you really work on dialing in your beer for that area, the food, and kind of growing from there as a neighborhood brew pub. You know, maybe if you do distribution, it's on a limited scale to promote your beer through kind of like quasi-advertising, or you just do it on a small scale for self-distribution. But the breweries that go into it full bore, with plans on distributing, you know, even before they really establish themselves at a location, they don't often have the best of luck.
John Wiegand, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
John Wiegand is a staff writer for MI Biz. You can find links to the stories on the state of the craft beverage industry at mibiz.com and also through a link at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.